Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Poison Pan. I'm Barbara Peters, and today we have the treat and privilege of launching Lisa Jewell's new book. As you can see right here, we have autographed copies, and we are so excited to be able to present it to you. So let me just say a few words about Lisa, although Lisa, why not wave so we'll know who's who?
I'm Lisa.
And over here is our host today, Claire McIntosh. So hi, Claire. Claire is wonderful, and I'm so delighted she's joined us. We've done two or three Zoom togethers before, and she's really just an excellent interviewer. So a few words about Lisa, who's the internationally best-selling author of 16 novels, including Then She Was Gone, I Found You, The Girls in the Garden, and The House We Grew Up In. I didn't know this. Her debut novel, Ralph's Party, was an instant Sunday Times bestseller. More recently, her book's been number one bestsellers in Canada, in the United Kingdom, as well as the United States, and have sold over 2 million copies across the English-speaking world and are translated into 16 languages. I was, alas, not here in 2018 when Lisa came to visit the Pen, but Patrick, who is with us today, was your host. So thank you for coming before, and I wish you were here live right now.
So do I. It's a tragedy, but it's lovely to be here with you in this format anyway. It's better than nothing.
It is indeed. So Claire McIntosh, her debut novel, I Let You Go, was the Richard and Judy Book Club pick, as her next two novels were. Now, let me say, for those of you who don't know what that means, that being a Richard and Judy pick is roughly like being an Oprah pick, or more recently, a Reese Witherspoon Hello Sunshine Club pick. In other words, it's a really big deal, sells lots of books. So Claire has written four novels, and we'll be publishing a fifth one when? Next year?
Yeah, next year, next fall, I think.
Fabulous. All right. So Claire, I think I'll just turn this over to you and we'll see where it goes.
Great. Thank you very much, Barbara, for those introductions. Oh, Lisa. Now, you and I have talked lots before. We've done a few events, a few online chats, a couple of real ones. And one of the things that I find is missing a little bit from Zoom events is that atmosphere. So I thought I'd warm us up a little bit by doing a little quiz. Okay, you feeling in the mood for a quiz?
I'm now terrified. Okay,
you've
not quick fire, is it?
No, I'll give you time to think, and we can always throw it open to the audience.
Excellent.
You've written 18 books, is that right? Invisible Girl is your 18th?
18th, yeah, and okay. I'm halfway through the 19th.
Fabulous. So I thought what I'd do is quiz you to see how much you know about your own books. Okay?
That's right. Really cool.
Okay.
There are only 10 questions. Right? I mean, okay. How hard can it be? Okay, so question number one. What country was Lily from I Found You from?
Ukraine.
Very good. Okay, off to a flying start. Question two. Which novel of yours features characters living in Virginia Terrace?
The Girls in the Garden.
Excellent. Are you feeling nervous?
I am.
Question number three. In Watching You, which is one of my favourites of yours, Freddie compiles a dossier full of the comings and goings of local people. What does he call it?
Is it called the Melville Chronicle? No.
I'll give you half a point for that. It's actually called the Melville Papers.
Oh, I think I don't deserve half a point. I think I deserve a point for that.
Question number four. What is the surname of maths tutor Noelle in Then She Was Gone?
Donnelly.
Good, you have redeemed yourself. Oh, right, I'm going to take you back now to 1999. Yeah. In Ralph's Party, where do Ralph, Jem and the other tenants live?
Almanac Road.
What number?
31.
Is it? I actually haven't written that down. I thought it was 32, but you might be right. You are
31 author. Is my lucky number. I've got loads of my house numbers are 31 because it's my lucky number.
I love that bit of trivia. Okay, number six. In this quote from The Family Upstairs, Birdie appears on our front step with two large suitcases and a what?
Cat in a wicker box.
Good, word for word. Right, number seven. In The Truth About Melody Brown, which is really quite a long time ago, I think, yeah. How old was Melody when her house burned down?
Eight. No, nine.
Nine, good.
Yes.
Number eight. In The Third Wife, Adrian is married to Maya, who meets a rather sticky end, but what are his two ex-wives called?
Caroline and Susie.
Very good. Right, number
I'm amazed.
Number nine. This is a quote from which novel of yours? She was only here because she didn't have the guts to be anywhere else. Because she felt like the last guest at an unsuccessful party, too guilt-ridden to leave.
Oh, you got me. I know it. I remember writing it, but it's to do with a marriage. Is it to do with a marriage?
So this is from The House We Grew Up In.
Yes. And who's married?
Go on.
Whose marriage was it? Can't remember.
I don't have that in my notes, okay, I'm afraid. You can't go fishing for bonus points. Right, last question then. In Invisible Girl, Sapphire Maddox is very specific about her ethnicity.
Yes.
What is her background?
She is mainly Welsh, a bit French, bit Trinidadian, and a bit... Mainly Welsh, a bit Trinidadian, a bit French, and a bit something else. Am I nearly there?
You are so nearly there. It's just the something else.
Welsh, Trinidadian. Oh, is it Malaysian?
It is. Hey! Well done. Congratulations.
I'm so impressed. You have no idea. I mean, I have spent 30 years backstopping authors when fans ask them questions about their earlier books or even the book we're presenting, and they turn to me with this deer in the headlights look and they go, what? I am so impressed, Lisa, that you were able to do that.
I am utterly stunned and amazed that I was able to do that. Yes.
So I declare you the national expert on Lisa Jewell books.
Fabulous. So
18 books then. Obviously, we want to talk about Invisible Girl, which is the book that that you're on tour to promote that's just come out. I've read it. I loved it. Absolutely fabulous. But I want to go right back to the beginning, first of all, because somebody told me that this your entire career is based on a bet.
Correct. Yes. And yeah, this is entirely true. Yes, I was not sort of set out on the path to becoming a best-selling novelist at the time that I started writing my first novel. In fact, I was set on the path to, a long career as a secretary. I'd sort of decided that's where my strengths lay, having tried all sorts of different jobs. And I was working as a secretary when I started writing my first novel, which was, as you say, as a result of a bet with a friend. Because as much as I was enjoying my work as a secretary, I'd also started doing evening classes in creative writing on the side, just to, you know, keep that sort of creative side of myself going. And so when I lost my secretarial job, and a friend of mine asked me what I was going to do now, I said I was going to sign up with some temp agencies to see if I could get some more secretarial work. And she said, but there must be something else you'd really like to do. And I said, well, I'd quite like to write a novel, but obviously that's not going to happen. That's just completely ridiculous. And so she made me make a bet with her that I would write three chapters and she'd take me out for dinner to my favourite restaurant if I did that. So I did shake hands with her and I did write three chapters and she did take me out for dinner to my favourite restaurant. Unfortunately, she also forced me to send those three chapters to some literary agents. And that was the first three chapters of Ralph's Party, which was my first novel.
And so does that mean that you did that thing that we're all told not to do, which is don't send your three chapters off to an agent until you've finished your book and polished it as much as you possibly can.
It was really naughty of me, and absolutely not the way that you're supposed to do it. And I would not, as much as it worked out for me, I would not recommend doing that to anybody else that's setting out, as I'm sure you would also not advise people to do that either, because until you've written a book, you've got no idea if you can write a book. And it's very important when you're sending a book to be judged that you know that you can write a book. So I took a bit of a gamble and it paid off, thankfully, but I wouldn't recommend it for anybody else.
No, although of course I know that you're in the very sort of, I think, peculiar position that those three chapters of a book probably don't change very much, do they? Because we've had discussions before about how I will throw away maybe 70% of my first draft. So if I were to send three chapters to an agent, there is absolutely no guarantee that it would relate to the finished book at all. Yeah. But you write a story from start to finish that comes out of your head. There's no plan, there's no note, and then it's done. Is that right? Really?
Yes, it is. Fundamentally, that is correct, give or take the occasional, you know, very, very occasionally something will go wrong and I'll think, oh God, I'm going to have to go back to chapter three and rework that because that's now not going to work in the light of what I've written in chapter 10. But that hardly ever happens. Normally, I come to my computer every day and I read back over the 1,000 words I wrote the day before, and then I write another 1,000 words, and then I shut my laptop and get on with my life, and then I come back the next day and do the same thing. So I never read back further than what I wrote the day before. And generally speaking, it's a matter of kind of committing to committing to what I've written. Is you know, just thinking, oh, I've written that, and now I'm just going to have to make it work. I try not to think too much that what I've written in the preceding chapters is stuff that's all up for, you know, up for conversation, and we can change that and we can get rid of that. I think, no, I've written that and I want to keep it. So what comes after that needs to work in conjunction with what I've already written. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And so with
that way of writing.
With that in mind then, does that mean that character is what leads your stories, that you know the characters, and so once they've done one thing, you'll follow them to their next plot point?
I wouldn't say I know the characters. I get to know them as I'm writing them, and they can sometimes take me on a merry dance and show themselves to be absolutely not what I brought them in the book to be at all. I like that in The Girls in the Garden, which we referred to earlier, there was a character in that book called Leo, who right from the beginning I thought, well, he's the bad guy, clearly he's a creep. Clearly, he was the guy who did the thing that got done, and I just need to, you know, unpeel the layers of the story till we get to the realisation that it was Leo who did it. And as I got to the closing chapters, I just knew without a shadow of a doubt that he did not have what it took. He was not that person. So the characters reveal themselves to me as I write, and that can be problematic sometimes. So I got to the end of writing The Girls in the Garden and thought, well, if it wasn't him, and who the hell was it? And then that's ploughing back through what I've already committed to on the page and pulling something out of that. I'm thinking, I'm using what I've already done rather than thinking, now I'm going to have to rewrite the whole thing. Yeah. I think, no, it's in there somewhere. Somewhere in what I've already written is the answer to this problem. And it always is. Like a little miracle every time it's there.
You're trusting your own process then as a writer. You're trusting the creative process.
Correct.
What you've written is leading you in the right direction.
Yes, and I think that comes with age, with great age, and with just experience. It just is. And certainly, I've had really, really scary times writing books over the years because I don't plan. I've had horrific times where I thought, it's not going to work. I'm not going to make this book work. And that's the glorious thing about getting to this point in my career, is just thinking, I will make this book work. I know I will. I have literally no clue how that's going to happen, but I know it's going to work. And I'm sort of at that point at the moment with the book I'm writing right now, because I'm at the sort of 55,000 word mark, which is when you think, okay, I really should be kind of on top of this by now, but I still really, I'm not entirely convinced that I know what this book's about or how it's all going to wrap up. But yeah, it's just feel the fear and do it anyway.
Basically. And you mentioned your thousand words and then you close your laptop. So is that your routine 5 days a week, 7 days a week? What does your writing day look like?
Oh, I'm going to answer this question and then I'm going to throw it straight back at you because I know about your writing routine and it's so fabulous. Your Wednesdays. I do all my busy stuff. I can't write if I've got things on my to-do list that are just nagging at me from the background. So in the morning, I do all my emails, I do all my housework, I walk the dog, I put a wash on. I just do all those little odds and ends that would just be hanging over my head otherwise. And then when that's all done, I start writing. And yeah, that's 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, 1,000 words every afternoon. And then the minute the first child returns from school, that's the end of the day. That's it. Shut the laptop and finished for the day. But yes, Claire, tell us about your...
Well, no, but it's all gone south in 2020. I did. So 2 years ago, I decided that I was working too hard because I work quite long days and I was traveling a lot. And so I committed to taking Wednesdays off completely and doing something really lovely. And so I would go off and do a craft course, or I'd meet a friend for lunch, or I'd go to the cinema in the day and watch two films back to back. You know, I would do what I call slightly pretentiously filling the well. You know, I would give myself time and space to think. It's all gone awry this year because, you know, homeschooling and 2020 and just everything. And now we've just got a pony, which means lots of stuff happening every day. So I think I'm going to have to reshape that.
Learning curve?
We are very, it's been 25 years since I've had a horse. And anyway, we digress. So what's your, for you, when's your time? So you've said you stop work when the kids get home. That's great, but that's, you know, that's still kids, still parenting. What do you do to fill that creative well?
Oh, Claire, now I feel lacking. I honestly don't do anything.
Do you binge on Netflix?
Yes, that's about the things I like doing when I'm not parenting, housekeeping or writing is dog walking. That's the important part of my day. I absolutely love that hour. Just, you know, I don't listen to music. I don't look at my phone. I just follow my dog and we walk and I love that. And then, yeah, every evening at 8 o'clock, we are like a Gogglebox family. We convene on the sofa and we find something addictive to watch that we're all desperate to watch. And so we all sit and watch something wonderful together. And that's kind of it. I don't go to the cinema. I read a bit before I go to sleep. That's it, really.
Are you able to read while you're writing?
Very much so, very much so. And I'm certainly, and I know a lot of genre writers are unable to read within their genre while they're writing. I don't have an issue with that. I love writing thrillers while I'm writing thrillers, reading thrillers while I'm writing thrillers. I don't find that off-putting in the slightest. My life is very compartmentalized, I would say. I don't know if you would say the same. I mean, harder to do that during lockdown with children all over the place. So I do compartmentalize my writing from my reading and my writing from my personal life. I can write incredibly upsetting or traumatic scenes and just shut that down. The minute I finish writing that scene, I can just put it in a box and get on with my life without carrying it around with me. Little boxes in my life, so everything's quite separate. It doesn't leach into each other.
And you mentioned genre just then, and I wanted to talk about your genre shift, because there is a shift, isn't there? Perhaps not as sort of stark as some authors who move from one thing to another in the space of a book, where I think yours is a more sort of progressive they become progressively darker and progressively more suspenseful. So was that a conscious move that you made?
Yes and no. I've certainly always had a taste for darker themes. And in fact, even in my so-called chick lit novels of the early days, people always used to say, well, it's chick lit, but it's chick lit with an edge, or it's chick lit, but it's got sort of like dark undercurrents. So there were things in some of my early books that were really quite subversive for the chick lit genre. So it was always there. And it's just a matter of, like, with each book, kind of pushing back on some elements. So easing off on the romance, easing off on the jokes. Someone wrote to me the other day to say they missed my jokes. And I thought, oh yeah, no, I used to be quite funny, didn't I? So easing back on the exclamation marks, easing back on the sort of kind of joie de vivre of writing in that genre, and pushing forward on the dark undercurrent, the secrets and the sort of, and just gradually moving one back and the other forward sort of at the same time. So kind of nobody even noticed I was doing it in a way. And I was aware of the fact that I was doing it. And every time I delivered a book, I was like, is this the one? Have I gone too far? Is my editor going to say, can we have a few more jokes and a little less darkness? But nobody ever said anything. Nobody ever told me to stop. So I just felt that I could just keep doing this. And my biggest fear was that I would lose some of my original readership. And I feel like I haven't, which is a great comfort to me. Because I've certainly grown a huge new readership, but I'm pretty confident that I've kept most of my original readership with me as well, which is really, really gratifying.
Well, I would imagine that some of those people who read Round the Party back in 1999, 2000, you know, they would have been quite young. If they were reading it, in their early 20s, they've grown up as well. And of course, life does get a little bit darker, and it does have more undertones, and it does get richer, and the jokes sadly can get a bit fewer. And so actually your readership, I think, will have grown up with you and can still enjoy both books. Do you occasionally have people who are a bit shocked when they discover you? So say someone discovers you now with Invisible Girl, loves it, says, right, I'm going to go right back to the beginning, read all her back catalogue. I'll start with Ralph's Party. Yeah. What would you say to them?
I would say, don't do it that way. people who've discovered me with my last few books say, I'd really like to get into your backlist. What would you recommend? And I say, please start at the top and work your way back, because there may come a point where you just think, this isn't for me anymore. This has got a bit girly, or this has got a bit
too many exclamations.
Too many jokes. So just work your way backwards until you hit the spot where you just think, nah, this isn't for me anymore. Obviously, ideally, they'd keep going till Ralph's Party and love every single one. But that's what I would say. It actually terrifies me, the idea of somebody jumping from Invisible Girl, say, to 30 Nothing, which was my second novel, which was probably the cheesiest and most romantic of my books. That sort of freaks me out a bit, because I think they might then feel lost and think, I thought I'd discovered a new author, but I don't know who she is, and I think I'll just walk away.
There's certainly, you mentioned jokes. There aren't out and out jokes in what you write now, but your characters are often very, very sharp. Sapphire, for example, in Invisible Girl has a quite a sort of an edgy, acerbic look on things. So you can see your humour creeping into those characters, I think.
Yeah, I definitely find it much easier to be funny when I write in the first person. So that I've done three really strong first person narratives over my last few books. One of them was Noelle, the maths tutor, in Then She Was Gone. Then I had Henry in The Family Upstairs, which was my last book. And then Sapphire in this one. And because I'm being them, I'm inhabiting them in a way that you do much more in the first person than in the third person. I think maybe more of my natural sort of, I was going to say my natural wit, but that makes me sound like I think I'm lost myself. I'm so naturally witty.
You are absolutely allowed to have natural wit. This is your talk. This is your moment, your stage. Tell us about your glossy hair as well, if you want, and your ability. ability to do calculus and algebra. This is your moment, Lisa.
Oh no, don't. I can't. But yes. So yes, it is nice when you're doing the first person and you can be a little bit more sort of free and liberal with your turns of phrase and your language. Yeah, and be funny maybe.
So we've mentioned Sapphire Maddox several times now. She's absolutely one of my favourite characters that you have written, I think. And in a moment, I want to know all about her specifically and whether you enjoyed writing her. But first of all, tell us about the book. Give us the pitch.
Okay, I cannot do a Claire McIntosh style glossy polished pitch. You are so good at this sort of thing and I'm so appalling at this sort of thing. And actually what I should start doing before I write books in the future is get the pitch down first and then write the book, because I write these ridiculous complicated books that are impossible to describe in more than 100 sentences. But I'm going to try and do my best. Yes, sir. Invisible Girl. So it is a story about, well, there are three narratives running through it. One of them is the guy called Owen Pick, who is a 33-year-old virgin. He lives in his aunt's spare bedroom. She hates him. She locks all the doors in her flat so that he can't go into any of the other rooms in her flat. And he works as a lecturer at a college, and we meet him when he's just been suspended from his job as a college lecturer because of complaints of sexual impropriety at the Christmas party. So we meet Owen, and he's cross because he's a virgin, he's cross because he lives in his aunt's flat, and now he's really cross because he's about to lose his job, and obviously he refutes the allegations. And across from Owen on this very fancy street in North London lives his family called the Fours, which is Kate, who's a physiotherapist, her husband Rowan, who's a child psychologist, and their two teenage children, Joshua and Georgia. And they've clocked Owen across the street. They already think he's a bit of a weirdo, and they think that he followed Georgia home from the tube station. So they've got their eye on him. And in this quite rarefied street, there's been a spate of sex attacks. And Kate points the police in the direction of Owen across the street in a sort of, you might want to check him out, he's a bit dodgy, he followed my daughter home from the tube station the other night. So the police are already looking at Owen askance. And then on Valentine's night, a young girl called Sapphire Maddox, who used to be a patient of Rowan's, she's 17 years old, and she goes missing from outside Rowan's house. And the spotlight falls firmly upon the strange guy across the street called Owen Pick. So it's a sort of, the structure is before and after. So there's before Valentine's night, where you get to see all these dynamics forming. And you also get to meet Sapphire Maddox and find out what she was doing outside Rowan's house on Valentine's night in the first place. And then there's after, which is the police investigation, which we can talk about. yes, that's it. Ta-da!
There's, I tell you what, as elevator pitches go, I mean, that's a heck of a tall building.
I cannot do them. They are, yeah.
There's a really strong sense of place in this novel. Actually, there is throughout all your novels. I feel they're really rooted in what feel like real worlds. And Invisible Girl in particular is a sort of have and have not novel, isn't it? So the sort of the beautiful house and the horrible flat, the tame animals, the wild animals. Tell us a little bit about the setting.
Yeah, so I live in a nice area of North London that's very close to this area of North London, which is beyond nice. It's, you know, it's incredibly well to do. And I've always looked upon, you know, I'm making it a diversion to walk the dog around there so I can gawp at all the beautiful houses and what have you. And then we had to move out of our house for 8 months while it was renovated. And I thought, why don't we go and live in, it's called Hampstead in North London. Let's go and live in Hampstead for 8 months. Let's go and live in one of these amazing houses. And I thought it was going to be an adventure. And I thought I was going to love living there. And from within like a week of moving into this apartment, this very grand apartment in a very grand house, I hated it. I just thought, I hate it here. I hate everybody who lives around here. There's a really strange atmosphere. I don't like walking around here at night. It's so dead and so quiet. I don't like the neighbors. I just felt uncomfortable. I just felt out of place. And all I wanted to do was go home. Didn't want to be there anymore. So I really enjoyed that, the sense of displacement that I felt, using that as a backdrop for Kate and her family, that she already feels weird and uncomfortable and out of place, and she doesn't want to be there. And then add into the mix, which wasn't happening to me, thankfully, when I was living in Hampstead, the sex attacks on your street and the strange guy over the way following your teenage girl home from the tube station and what have you. So that for me was, that was the starting point of wanting to set it there, was just to fill the atmosphere of just this wrongness. So into that, it's always fun to play with contrast, isn't it? And this is one of the things that I love about London, which I think a lot of people who don't know London don't appreciate about London, is that unlike a lot of cities, it's cheap by jowl. You've got social housing, cheap by jowl with millionaire mansions. I really wanted to play with that. So Sapphire lives in a tower block on the 10th floor of a huge council estate. But yet she's just around the corner from this grand avenue of grand mansions with electronic gates and security cameras and what have you. So that was a contrast that I really wanted to explore. And I do wonder how that will play out for American readers, actually, because I don't know if they'll be able to picture that when they're reading it, Barbara.
Interesting. Let's bring her in.
I could speak up and say that it depends on very much on the city, because, you know, we're such a big country. But here in Phoenix, for example, the zoning has always been uneven. And so you can have a really grand gated community right next to something completely different and old, because we grew in part by developers annexing ranches. So they would, you know, buy a large plot of land, but it wasn't tied in necessarily to anything else. So Los Angeles is like that. Lots of Western cities in particular that have grown in that manner would not be at all surprised. It may be more homogenous than other cities. New York, you know, is just famous for, or infamous, or you want to look at it, for gentrification that is a constant process. So, you know, one place will go up and another place will go down, and then it will all change again, and then you come back full circle and on and on and on. So I think Americans easily understand that. I can't remember the terms, but talking to Ian Rankin yesterday, for example, we were translating just a few terms for American readers. For example, you call it upmarket and we call it luxury. So, you know, that's
upmarket.
No, we never say upmarket. We say luxury. Okay. Ian in Edinburgh will say, no, not really. The market part doesn't come in, but we were talking about tenements. So in Edinburgh, you can live in a really lovely flat in a tenement. And in America, that's our version of council housing. So when you talk about a council estate, we don't know what that means. But, you know, for us, it's basically public housing. And a tenement is usually, right, Patrick, considered a rickety, you know, old.
Yeah, that's what I thought a tenement was. I always thought of tenements as being those poor housing terraces in Glasgow. Never thought of tenements as being upmarket. No.
And then, we say sidewalk, you say pavement. And then in Edinburgh, for example, a cobblestone, if it's square, is a set, S-E-T-T. So, you know, language, our common language does divide us quite a lot of the time. But I think that your portraits of London make perfectly good sense, you know, for Americans. And I wouldn't worry about it. And I also am not a fan of translating British into American,
this comes up at nearly every American book event I do, is this idea of the Americanization, which I do because you do. But every time I do a book event in America and the subject comes up, every reader at the event says, no, don't change anything. We like it. We want it all the British words. We like all the British words. But then I always use as an example, does anybody know what a people carrier is? And everybody goes, no, I don't know what a people carrier is. I say, well, you know, there are some things that I think are worth changing, because if you're reading a book and you see people carrier and you don't know what it is, you're thrown. You're completely lost.
Well, that's very true. Caravan is one of those words if you're talking to somebody.
Which one?
Caravan, if you're, you know, and we call it a trailer or, you know, an RV, a recreational vehicle. So those can throw you. But no, actually, over the years, we've done really well by importing the British books so that the American readers don't have to read the translated American version. But we like to think our customers are, you know, eager for the entire authentic experience. So there we are. Yeah. Right.
Well, that's the thing. As I've published more and more in American, I've got more confidence. I veto quite a lot of the suggested Americanizations now. And I very much just think, is this really going to throw your average American reader? And if I think it's not going to throw them, I'm not putting cookie for biscuit. I think if you're a reader and you've read British books, you will know that we call cookies biscuits. So, you know, but something like a people carrier, I'm very happy to change that.
Now it's a subject goes on and on and on, but
it's such a fascinating subject.
I want to come back to what you were saying about the displacement and the sort of the haves and the have nots, because nowhere is this theme of have and have not as well illustrated as in the character of Owen Pick, who definitely considers himself to have not something in particular. So could you talk to us about the murky, horrible world? I actually feel a little prickly and uncomfortable. Yeah. Of the incels.
Yeah. Yes. So incels, and I'm surprised by how many people don't know about this world of incels. Incel is short for involuntary celibate. So it's an online community of men around the world who identify as involuntary celibates, which basically means that they would like to have sex, but no women will have sex with them. And rather than taking that on the chin and thinking, well, that's life, you know, they kind of politicize it. It's quite upsetting. I have not been on an incel forum, but I have read reports and seen documentaries from people who have been on incel forums and interviews with incels themselves. And it's quite upsetting. It's beyond misogyny. It goes into a whole darker realm than even, you know, your wildest imaginings of misogyny. It's a sense that you're owed it and society is withholding it from you, and therefore you need to punish people. And there have been some terrorist attacks from people who identify as involuntary celibates. There's extremism and so with Owen, as I set up at the beginning, we meet him at a very low point and he's cross about all sorts of things. And I wanted to put him into the incel world and see what the incel world would do to him and whether they'd be able to radicalize him. He meets a guy called Bryn, who's very charismatic. He's got a blog, he's very high profile online in the incel community, and he sort of mentors Owen in a way. I just wanted to see, because I wasn't sure, because I don't plan anything. And as much as I was very fond of Owen when I was writing him, I still wasn't sure what he was capable of. So I needed to offer him some opportunities to really go dark. So that's why I brought the incel community into the book, was really just to see what Owen would do with it.
And it really is a dark theme, but he's not the only one that has darkness. I mean, Sapphire introduces herself by telling us something terrible happened to me when I was 10. And we don't know exactly what that is for a while, but she is in a very bad place and has been for a number of years.
Yes, exactly.
Ladies, We have a lot of questions, according to
Patrick. They're backing up.
So would it be okay if we break in
of
here
course.
First? And yeah, let's for it, step forth and present a few questions to you here.
Just to say hi to them.
Patrick is going to sit down. We're changing places.
Hi there. I just wanted to say hi, and
hello.
I had the pleasure of hosting Lisa when she was here last time, and we had a great time. So I just wanted to say hi, and also just briefly, when I was in London for the first time over Christmas last year, we stayed in Earl's Court, and I remember going down to the tube station and seeing this massive Lisa Jewell advertisement in the tube station, and it was pretty cool.
Oh, can you remember which book it was? Was it The Family Upstairs?
Crikey. I can't, I'm sorry.
It was a book.
Let's see. So yeah, we have a bunch of questions here. And Sarah asks, she says, Lisa, you're one of my favorite authors. Which of your book was the most challenging to write and why?
Yes. Certainly most of the first few, because I was an inexperienced writer, so they were much more challenging. But of the later books, where I should have kind of been hitting my stride a bit, The Third Wife, which was my first thriller. And that was why it was challenging to write, because I changed my mind halfway through about what sort of book it was supposed to be. It was going to be a family drama about a man who's been married multiple times, and the impact that would have on his families that he's left behind, and the children of the first wife and the second wife, and the dynamics. And which I'd been wanting to write this book for ages. I was so excited about writing this book, The Multi-Married Man. And then I got halfway through it and just thought, I'm actually quite bored. This isn't giving me what I thought it was going to give me, and decided that I would kill someone. So this was the first time I killed someone in a book. So I took his third wife, who was called Maya, and threw her under a night bus on Charing Cross Road. And then really had to work so hard to, as I was saying earlier, I write things and I keep things. So to make everything that I'd already written work in the context of a dead body in the first chapter was very, very painful and very challenging, but I did it. So, there you go, third wife.
All right. Let's see. Anne asks, Lisa, which other authors do you enjoy reading?
Oh, Claire McIntosh. Claire McIntosh is very much in my top five. It's awful, actually, because my favorite writers is not very diverse. It's all basically English women writing psychological thrillers. I feel I could be more diverse, but that's what I just love, British psychological thrillers. So Claire McIntosh, Ruth Ware, I love Ruth Ware, Sabine Durrant, who I'm not sure is published in America. If she isn't, she should be. And Tammy Cohen, and someone else who I'll remember the minute I switch my computer tonight. But yes, I'm a big fan of my contemporaries, basically.
Okay, same question for Claire.
Oh, my favorite. Well, I mean, it's a little bit like just repeating Lisa's answers. I'm a massive Ruth Ware fan as well. But I flit between general fiction and crime fiction. So I adore Jojo Moyes. Jodie Picou she's just my absolute literary hero. So I'll read anything she writes. But again, female writers, and I noticed I keep a record of what I read. Read somewhere in the region of 100, 110 books a year. And when I look back over my record, I would say 70%, maybe even 80% are by women. And out of the books that I have loved, and I put a little star next to them if I've given a quote or I recommend them, they are maybe 90% female authors. So I think I need some recommendations for good male authors.
Yeah.
Let's see. This is interesting. We don't get this question very often. Do you prefer to read physical books or ebooks or a combination of both? Kind of an interesting marketing question, really.
Physical books I can't read on screen. Well, I can read on screen clearly, but I don't enjoy reading on screen. Which has been quite awkward during lockdown when there weren't any physical copies advanced reader copies available, and publishers kept offering me PDFs. It's like, oh no, you can send it to me, but I'm probably not going to read it, which is, yeah, definitely paper books. What about you, Claire?
Yeah, paper books. I find that it's actually the prospect of reading an ebook that I hate more than the actual process. Once I'm reading it, as long as it's actually on an e-reader, not on a laptop or an iPad. If it's on a proper e-reader, once I'm reading it, if it's a good book, then it's fine and I can go with that. But what I do notice is that I don't remember, so I couldn't tell you what book I'm reading on Kindle at the moment. I can't tell you the title, I can't tell you the author, because I don't see that cover. And the process of picking up a paperback or a hardback, you know, every night to read it really cements that memory, I think. And so from a marketing point of view, I worry a little bit about, you know, the way ebooks are presented, because I just don't think they're as memorable.
I think you're absolutely right. I think if you've read all of my books or all of your books and you've got them and you've had them in your hand and you put them on your bookshelf, you'll feel a much more of a connection or a memory of the fact that you've read a Claire McIntosh book or you've read a Lisa Jewell book. I think when they're just all stored up on a device, you haven't got that clarity and, like you say, that emotional memory of having read the book, which is hugely important when you want to build a readership and, you know, build a brand.
It is, but I'm not anti ebooks at all. You know, I'm hugely supportive of anyone that reads on Kindle or Kobo or whatever. Particularly, I've heard from lots of readers who use the change in font means that they can read books that they wouldn't be able to read in print because the font's too small. You know, they're much more accessible, or people that can't hold a book and can now read on e-readers. So there are huge benefits, but I'd always ask for a print book first.
There's something therapeutic about having your library and your books around you. You know, and seeing that row of books behind Claire there. You know, when you go into somebody's house and you don't see any books, something just seems wrong, doesn't it?
No. Yes, yeah. You're like, house of a sociopath.
Exactly. Somebody who you may know, Lisa, I won't say who, asks, Lisa, does anyone read your books as you're writing them? Or do you write the whole draft before getting friend, family, agent, editor feedback?
This is a question from someone I know.
I think maybe
Is this Lisa's husband now?
Yeah. Am I? Are you not going to tell me who it is?
Oh. Shall I?
Who?
Ariel.
Nobody reads what I've written until it's finished. No. Although I do give my UK editor gets a first draft, because that's really unusual. Usually you show your first draft to your agent, or maybe you don't show your first draft to anyone, Claire.
I show my first draft goes simultaneously to my editor and my agent.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But yes, so no, but I don't. In fact, my first couple of books I had readers for, friends who I'd send the chapters to as I finished them, but I haven't done that for a long time.
I have a number of people weighing in on the, you know, including Britishisms and keeping purity of the British language, you know, in your American editions. And I couldn't agree more. You know, we want to raise the bar for our readers, don't we? I mean,
well, that's what, yeah. But you know what's so interesting, and I never really understand this, is that when British publishers buy American books to publish in the UK, they're published in full American. So there's no you in favor. It's a sidewalk, it's not a pavement. It's Z's instead of S's. They don't change anything for the British market.
But I wonder if that's partly due to the influences of film and television.
Yeah.
We, as a small nation, are very, very used to imported American TV dramas and films, whereas perhaps not so much the other way. And I think what I've noticed from American readers is that really big readers, so people who are reading upwards of 50 books a year, don't seem to be worried about Britishisms.
Yeah.
And I think perhaps because their exposure is much greater. Whereas if you are an occasional reader, and it's difficult for us sitting in this lovely virtual bookshop to remember that there are people that read maybe one book a year on holiday, or maybe, you know, one at Christmas as well. And actually, if that book they pick up is written in British English and everything else they see is American, then that might be confusing, or, you know, they might think it's a mistake.
Yes. No, that's quite, I've seen that actually, not in relation to my own books, but I've seen readers think that they've spotted a typo or a mistake when it's actually just British English. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, it's funny. Occasionally it'll make its way into a title of a book. You know, Ian Rankin, as Barbara was talking about, had a book called, Flesh Market Close. Yeah, in the UK. And of course, that is a completely unknown term here in America. So it was called Flesh Market Alley here.
Oh, close, as in the small road.
Yeah. Between the buildings, I believe. Yeah. Let's see. Okay. Well, also, I was just thinking about Denise Mina, you know, reading, you know, Glaswegian dialect. It can be challenging, you know. Or Irvin Welsh, or somebody like that, who's just completely, you know, idiomatic.
To be fair, that's quite challenging for us as well.
Yes, even. Claire actually lives in Wales. Claire lives in rural Wales. And you can speak Welsh, can't you?
I can speak a little bit of Welsh.
Yeah.
So is Owen Pick Welsh?
No, he's just got, Owen. It's got Welsh roots, but he's not Welsh. And Pick is, I just love one syllable surnames.
That's
a
great
name. I use it as much as I can. Yeah.
Sounds a little bit like a Dickensian character.
Yeah. I love just those short shot, bang, one syllable surnames.
Well, let's see here. Catherine says, loved The Invisible Girl, read it in one sitting. How long does it usually take you to write a book?
I would say, so I write in two chunks of the year. So from March to July, I probably write about a third of the book, and then I stop writing for the summer. And then from September to December, I write the second two thirds of the book. So I can't work out the maths on that. How many months is that? Is that 7 months?
About that, yeah.
And two big hits, yeah. Yes, about 7 months, I would say. But yeah, the bit from January to March, in case you're wondering, in case you think I'm just sitting around, is editing the book that was finished in December.
Let's see. Sherry says, love reading British books, reading the different words, etc. How do you come up with the book covers? They are beautiful. Do you have input? I guess that's a question for both of you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, I mean, it's just, I don't have to have any input, because I give my American publishers a manuscript, and then at some point I'll get an email with an attachment saying, ta-da, here's your, and I'll open it and it'll download and I'll get really excited and get butterflies. And then there's something like this waiting for me. So I don't need to have any input, because they're geniuses. So, you know.
That is beautiful. Have you got your English cover of Invisible Girl there?
No, I haven't got it with me. I'm not at home at the moment. No, it's, but which is also very attractive.
They're quite different, aren't they?
There's less difference between this one and my English one than previous books. The English one is like, so Sapphire Maddox spends quite a lot of time looking through a wooden fence for various reasons, which become clear if you read the book. And it's like a wooden fence, but it's similar. It's got plants all over it and what have you, so quite similar. What about you, Claire?
I have very little inputs, really. I'm a firm believer in everyone being an expert in the thing they're supposed to be doing. And so, you know, my area of expertise is in writing the books.
Yes.
I have an awful lot of support on that from brilliant editors. But yeah, I'm not a cover designer. I'm not a marketer. I'm not a publicist. And so whilst I love to have thoughts and feed in ideas, I really trust my team to do what they've got to do.
100%. I agree with you 100%.
Have you ever had any shocking covers though, Lisa, that you don't have to be specific about?
Yes, particularly in the early days with the chicklit novels, with the cartoons that just sort of, I don't know if they published, chicklit was published very differently in America. But in the UK, chicklit was published with these really infantilized cartoon covers. And my first couple of my books were quite quirky and I thought they were quite cool. And then there were a few where I just sort of, come on, this is not a book for 5-year-olds. Let's just sort of, I have had a couple of moments where I've had to say, that's really quite bad. I'm sorry. Have you had any disasters?
No, nothing that I would speak about here. No. Patrick, what's next?
Pam asks, she says, I love audiobooks. Claire and Lisa, do you listen to your own audiobooks? I'm sure you do. And can you talk about the process behind audiobooks? Do you have a hand in selecting the different readers and whatnot?
Well, this has been the most incredible thing that's happened with audiobooks, which used to just be a sort of a little thing that happened in the background that you never thought about. There were just people in studios making audiobooks and you didn't know who they were. And then the audiobook came out and it went into some libraries and you didn't really think about it. And now they've just exploded. So having had no input into audiobooks at all over my entire career, the last few books, it's been this massive thing because they're now so lucrative. They make so much money for publishers. So they want to get, you know, the absolutely top dollar actors to narrate. I get sent, I'm sure you do as well, Claire, little sound bites of various people to see who you think sounds the most like the character as they sound in your head. So it has become a huge thing. And with lockdown as well, with all these poor British out of work actors, we've been getting the creme de la creme because of course they can do an audiobook from home. So while we were all locked down, there were loads of really, you know, top class actors doing audiobooks, which was quite...
There's been a lot of Hollywood actors recording from their wardrobes underneath duvet covers. Which I think is brilliant. I recorded one of my audiobooks, not the novels, but I did a non-fiction book a couple of years ago, which is a sort of, they call it a memoir. It's not really a memoir. It's a collection of magazine columns about my family. And I recorded that. And it was the most exhausting process to be in that recording studio, in that little booth, trying to keep your voice the same sort of level, the same speed, not letting your mouth make funny clicking noises. I mean, it's a difficult skill. And although I don't listen to that because I think listening to my audiobooks would be an odd thing, my children listen to it. And in normal times, when I'm traveling, that's what they listen to at bedtime. They hear stories about themselves read by their mother, which is a sort of weird meta writer.
Gosh, that really is. Wow, I'm surprised.
That's got to be kind of surreal.
Yeah.
It's quite surreal if I go upstairs, if I'm home, and they've gone to sleep and they've left their iPods running, to go up to their floor and discuss and hear my voice coming out.
Mummy's voice echoing across the landing.
Yeah, I used to read for the record for the blind and dyslexic. There's some groups here. And I enjoyed it, but it's really difficult, you know, reading. You know, you become conscious of how much you screw up when you're reading, leave out words, et cetera. Okay, so just one final question here. Julie asks, she says, the house we grew up in just gripped me. Where did that story come from?
Oh, now this was a rare occasion where I had like an elevator pitch moment, actually. So I was supposed to have started writing my new book. I did not have an idea for my new book, which is very unusual. I've normally already got an idea ready to go. So I just spent 2 weeks walking around. I thought, I'm just going to keep walking and walking and walking until I think of something to write about. And I looked up at a window, and it was clearly the window of a hoarded property. You know, when the sort of curtains haven't been opened and they're all thick with dust, and there were piles of things on the windowsill right up to the top. And I found myself thinking, I wonder who lives there? How the hell did their life get like that? And what must it be like to be related to someone like that? And that was it. I thought, that's what I need to do. I need a hoarded house. I need a family, a dysfunctional family who unhoard the house and therefore, you know, are healed. So it was like, oh, I've got an arc. I have an elevator pitch. So that was a very rare one for me. It was quite magical, actually, the way that fell into my head.
Yeah, I remember talking about it at length when you were here. That was just a fascinating idea for a book.
Yeah, it wrote itself. It did, genuinely, that book wrote itself.
Well, I'm going to swap again with Barbara. Nice seeing you both.
Lovely to see you. I'll see you in real life next time. Right.
Hi, ladies. I think we've come up over the top of the hour, so I'm going to say goodbye. But I was really laughing when you were talking about, I can't read digitally because I have an eidetic memory. So I remember where on the page everything is. So if you're reading a digital file, you can't do that. So I say to publishers, you know, send me the PDF and then I print them out, because I'm used to reading manuscripts as an editor anyway. So I have spent the last few months with these enormous stacks of printed manuscripts, which I read and discard as I go, but at least I can retain it. And there's a lot of scientific evidence that children reading all electronically don't remember things well. I think it's really a very different experience.
I think you're right.
You know, I agree with all the benefits that Claire mentioned about being able to adjust the font and the light and the whole bit, and I think that's great. But for me, paper will always be the thing. I wanted to thank Claire, and in my introduction, I completely forgot to mention that Claire has come to crime writing the authentic way, and that she was a police officer before she took up crime writing. So she has an extra little bit of authenticity there, I think. Do you miss being a policewoman?
No, not in the slightest. And in fact, the further I get away from the police, the more liberties I take with my writing. And one day I might be as relaxed as Lisa is about police procedure.
Oh, we haven't got time for that anecdote, I don't think.
Got time. I'm sorry, Barbara, I'm going to overrule the timing. I'm going to tell you a really quick story.
Okay.
I was reading a very early copy of Invisible Girl. It was a privilege to do so. And I wrote a quick note to her editor to say, I'm reading this book, I'm really loving it. Is it too late to feedback on a fairly sort of significant police procedural error in this book, you know, because I know that if I make mistakes in my books, I want to correct them. And then I carried on reading the book while I was waiting for the editor to get back to me, only to get to the end of the book where Lisa quite clearly states in her author letter, I will have made lots of mistakes and I don't care. I don't research. I don't do research. It's boring. And I guess that was my answer.
I love it. Years ago, I remember talking to or listening to Robert Barnard, whom I truly miss. He's an absolutely wonderful writer. Scandal in Belgravia is one of my all-time favorite kind of classical mysteries. But he was speaking about Christiana Brand, who was a famous Golden Age author. And her way of dealing with police procedure was to write her book, and then she would insert a line that said, and the police pursued their meticulous inquiries. That was her entire police investigation routine. And Bob and I thought that really she did that well. It was great.
I'm making notes.
I love it. Anyway, this has just been a delight. Thank you so much for sharing an hour with us. We've been so pleased to see you again, Lisa, and see you, Claire, for either the third or fourth time. So it's been wonderful. That's an advantage of Zoom. So congratulations on publication day, and I hope that the rest of your week goes fabulously.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Claire. Thank you. You are just amazing. You are
always a pleasure. Thanks so much, Barbara. See you soon, girls.
Thank
Bye,
you.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for watching, everyone.
Thank you indeed.
Bye.
Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.